We'll be reading in a moment from the first chapter, so you can turn there and be ready when the time comes. Last time, three Lord's Days ago in the evening, we began our introduction to this extraordinary book of the Bible, the book of Proverbs, by pointing out several things. Proverbs belongs to the wisdom literature of the Bible, a part of biblical revelation dealing with the how-to of godly living, practical counsel that equips a believing man or a believing woman for godly living. A godly life in a world that is no friend to godliness. Despite the prejudice of some nowadays to the contrary, it's not moralism, an undue attention to behavior, to concentrate on the how-to of biblical living. It's only to be true to the Bible, which has not only in the wisdom literature, but in many other places, a great deal of instruction, practical instruction, regarding right living and how it is to be achieved. Practical tips, as it were, for building a godly character. These are matters too fine, as one author has it, to be caught in the mesh of the law of God, and too fine and too detailed simply to be deduced from the gospel without the explicit teaching of the Bible. Biblical wisdom, in the second place, is best understood as the skill of living rightly. The idea is illustrated in the Bible by comparing it to the innate talent of creatures such as ants, locusts, and lizards, which though weak in themselves and in comparison to their predators, have been given wisdom by their Creator that enables them to navigate the dangers of their environment and make a success of their lives. The nature of biblical wisdom is also illustrated by the use of the term in the Bible to describe the ability of an artist or a craftsman who can bring a mental idea beautifully into life in paint or wood or fabric or stone. The Bible doesn't, but we might just as well use the word to describe the gifts of a great musician or composer, and nowadays perhaps of a particularly fine filmmaker. Wisdom in human life is the skill of bringing the mental idea of godliness and righteousness beautifully into flesh and blood living, that is, into thought and to word and to deed. One scholar put it this way: in the literature of Scripture, wisdom is, broadly speaking, the knowledge of God's world and the knack of fitting oneself into it. Given the fact that Proverbs, as the opening chapters testify, was intended for the instruction of Israelite children and young people in the first place, the question and answer of Alfred de Vigny, the 19th century French poet and writer, is spot on. He asks, "What is a great life?" And answers, "It is a thought conceived in the fervent mind of youth, executed with the solid force of manhood." Well, that's what Proverbs is all about. The clear idea of the way and the habit and the attitude of the godly life in a form that can be taught to children, but which is intended to be executed in one's adult life. In Proverbs, it is not live and learn. It is learn and live. Third, the fact that some of this how-to teaching that we find in Proverbs can be found in some cases virtually verbatim in the wisdom teaching of other peoples, unbelieving peoples, is only to be expected, given that all men have the law of God written upon their hearts. All men have been made in the image of the same one true and living God. Jesus Christ looked like any other human being. Our Christian faith has always taught some things that are taught in other religions of the world. We know that. And every Christian sooner or later observes and even ponders the fact that some wise unbelievers know that certain things are necessary for right living, just as we do, and alas, in some cases, seem to know that better than some Christians that we know. Though, to be sure, as we said, this instruction, however like in some respects it is to the wisdom teaching of the Egyptians and the Sumerians, is given a completely different foundation, a completely different theological context in the biblical book. Fourth, we said, though there are other forms of writing in the book of Proverbs than what we think of as Proverbs per se, the book contains a great many of those typical Proverbs, hence its name. Proverbs in our usage are short, pithy observations, admonitions, warnings, prohibitions, or encouragements from the experience of life. But the Hebrew word translated proverb, mashal, while it can certainly mean brief, terse sentences containing illustrations for life, in fact refers to a wide variety of different kinds of things or writings. It's more flexible, the Hebrew term. It is used in the Bible to refer to sayings, to didactic poems, to wisdom psalms, and to parables. We remember, for example, that Jesus was a teacher of wisdom. He is, in fact, according to the Bible, wisdom incarnate. And his preferred form of mashal was not the short, pithy observation, but the parable, the little story from which he drew his lesson. The Proverbs are different, so we say, not only in form, as I just mentioned, but they are different as well in kind. Some Proverbs are descriptive. They teach us what the world is like. Not what it ought to be, but how it actually is. Others are prescriptive. They teach us what we ought to do or think or say. Some Proverbs are generalities. They say what is often or usually true, but not necessarily true without exception. Others are statements of universal truth, are true always and everywhere and in all circumstances. Wisdom, you see, can tell the difference between the one kind and the other, and understands that there is what Professor Jack Collins calls a situational applicability to various general truths. In his syllabus on Proverbs that he from which he teaches at Covenant Theological Seminary, he uses the example of young children screaming indoors. And you parents, thinking perhaps you should equip them with a shock collar in order to teach them not to scream. Every time they scream, they'll get a shock and they'll learn not to scream. Don't scream, you tell them. However, there are times when a scream is entirely appropriate. In fact, there are times when you hope they will scream. If they're in danger, you want to know, you want to hear. Or if, in fun, you're jumping out from behind the door to scare them, you expect them to scream. Different circumstances require different responses. That's situational applicability, and you find that regularly in Proverbs. Further, some Proverbs apply to some people more than they apply to others, and so on. So the Proverbs in the biblical book are of all kinds of literary form and different in their nature as well. And fifth and finally, we said that this wisdom is vital to the Christian life. Many true believers lack it and in some tragic ways make shipwreck of their lives or the life of their children as a result. We're not talking about simply the difference between better and best. We are talking about matters that are of the very greatest importance, that bear mightily on the salvation of others, especially our children, upon our witness and our influence as Christians in the world, and upon the happiness and the fruitfulness of our lives. I deal with unwisdom in Christian living all the time and see the great and unhappy effects of that unwisdom. As I said, it's a painful reality and mystery of divine providence that some Christians are less wise in the ways of the world than some unbelievers that we know. This shouldn't be, but alas, it is. Wisdom is where the rubber meets the road, and every Christian, no matter his or her maturity, needs more of it than he or she has. All that from last time. Tonight I want to complete my introduction to the book. This is important because you're going to understand each particular section of teaching and indeed each particular proverb, whether a discourse or a particular short, a pithy statement or illustration of life. You'll understand each of them much better if you have a clear sense of the book and its purpose and its nature as a whole. To that end, I want to read this evening verses 7 through 19, the paragraph that follows the introduction we read last time. We read verse 7 the last time, but we'll read it again this evening with some comment. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. It's highly interesting and important that the fear of the Lord has no counterpart in pagan wisdom, in the pagan wisdom of the period, Egyptian wisdom and Babylonian wisdom and so on. We have here proof of the point we made the last time that however similar some of the proverbs may be to those in the literature of other ancient Near Eastern peoples, the religious principle is completely different. And that's often the case in our life. We do some of the same things unbelievers think they should do, but we do them with a different power, for a different reason, in a different expectation, with a different dependence upon the Lord. It's also important to observe here at the outset the fact that according to Proverbs and the rest of the Bible, for that matter, the commitment of the heart determines the thinking and ultimately the way of life. We'll consider this point in detail next time, but for now, take note of the fact that verse 7 is virtually making the same point that we have in chapter 4, verse 23. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. The Lord, you remember, will say something of the same thing. Out of the heart flow the issues of life. The heart, the seat of our convictions, our attitudes, our loves, our longings, that's what makes us the people we are, the heart that we have. In the Bible, fear of the Lord means unconditional reverence for and surrender to the Lord in the covenant. It's a basic attitude of willing submission in the heart based on the nature of God as we have come to know Him and the covenant He has made with us and the salvation that He has given to us in His grace. That's why in Proverbs and in the rest of the Bible, men are divided into just two classes, always just two classes, scoundrels and saints, the wicked and the righteous, the wise and the foolish. Because at last there are really only two possible heart commitments, though the conduct of people may vary quite widely from time to time. We know that Christians still sin. We know that unbelievers do some good things. But the heart is the true self and the determiner of life. Now, this fear of the Lord in the Bible is never mystical. It's never simply a feeling. It has a content, and that content is the law of God and it is His revealed covenant, including the wisdom instruction that we are given in Job and Proverbs and some of the Psalms and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Songs. Warm thoughts about God are not the fear of the Lord. Nor is a craven fear when one of us or the other fears the judgment of God because of something we have done. The fear of the Lord is reverence demonstrated in obedience. But wisdom is not simply obedience, and this, I think, is the important point as we launch away into the book. It is obedience. In fact, it's easy to show that the commandments, especially the Ten Commandments, 5 through 10, are all present and accounted for in the Proverbs. There are Proverbs about honoring your parents, about murder, about adultery, about theft, about honest speech, about coveting things that belong to others. But there is more here in Proverbs than simply obedience to the commandments of God's law. Obedience to those commandments we may regard as the rock bottom requirement of faith in God and Christ, but the Bible looks for more than that. It's looking for character. It's looking for virtue, for a particular way of life, down to the attitudes and down to the details. You cannot find in the law, for example, the many faceted teaching regarding speech, your speech, that we're going to find in Proverbs. Or the teaching about the gentleness of a person's character, as might be exemplified in his teaching of animals. We find that in Proverbs. We do not find that in the law of God. Or his caution before leaping into commitments, or his commitment to hard work. This is the sort of thing you find in wisdom literature, but you don't find in the Ten Commandments, per se. Proverbs is seeking to instill in us, Jack Collins says, sanctified common sense. That's character. That's virtue. It's more than obedience, as the law defines obedience. There's a very real sense, by the way, in which the letter of James in the New Testament, which identifies itself as, at the very beginning of the letter, as being about wisdom, and then talks more about wisdom in the middle of it. We're going to read those two sections from James during the Lord's Supper this evening. There's a very real sense in which the letter of James in the New Testament is the Proverbs, the book of Proverbs in the New Testament, because it is also dealing intimately with this question of character, of virtue in the life. This is more than simply obedience to the commandments of God's law. It includes that obedience, but it goes beyond it. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. Now, we come to the first discourse in the book. You'll notice quickly that the opening chapters of Proverbs are cast in the form of an exhortation to his son by a wise and godly father. And he's speaking in praise of a life of wisdom, and he's urging his son to seek it and to get it for, at all costs, for a variety of reasons. Notice quickly, for example, the opening words of chapters 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. My son, listen, my sons, followed by some exhortation to lay hold of a life of wisdom and live accordingly. This is, of course, itself wisdom, an example of how children are to be raised in believing homes, with an affectionate father and mother, constantly impressing upon the hearts and minds of their children the lessons of godliness and the practice of skillful living as the children of God. The teaching very clearly has been universalized in Proverbs. No particular son is named, as in the Egyptian wisdom books, for example. This is to be every Israelite father and every Israelite mother and every Israelite family. What's more, the New Testament makes it clear that Proverbs is also instruction for every Christian. Proverbs is cited or alluded to some 100 times in the New Testament. For example, the author of Hebrews quotes the father's admonition to his son in chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. He takes that as being addressed to the church, to every believer. For they are a graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Already, as in each of these discourses that follow through chapter 9, we have descended to particulars. Wisdom has much to do with one's choice of friends and one's handling of what we would today refer to as peer pressure. The choice of one's friends will always prove to be one of the most consequential choices any young person ever makes, one that bears mightily on how he or she is eventually going to live his or her life. C.S. Lewis beautifully puts this same principle in the positive, which is put in the negative here by the Father. The next best thing to being wise oneself is to live in a circle of those who are. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without reason. Now, it's unlikely that the peer group would describe their intentions in just that way. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. But the father is forcing his son to reckon with what actually is being meant and intended by what is being said and done. Forcing his son's attention through the outer veneer into the living reality beneath. He wants his son to realize what the temptation of one's peers can amount to. A temptation that seems so beguiling, so attractive at the moment, but leads to such ugly and awful things. So he forces him to reckon with the brutality, the injustice, the callousness of what these people are intending to do. And isn't that right? And isn't it true to human life? It changes the nature of a temptation in our minds altogether to see through it to its real end and its real result. Changes the nature, for example, of a temptation to a young man posed by a prostitute, which we're going to hear about in chapter 5 and chapter 7, to be forced to face the fact that the poor girl is doing what she does because she's been forced into it, because she has to. She hates her life, but she thinks she has no choice. That you would never want your sister to be condemned to such a demoralizing and degrading way of earning a living. This girl probably goes home to weep her night away for finding herself in the situation she finds herself in, over what has become of her life. No pimp wants a John to think thoughts like that, but a father is absolutely right to lay the axe to the root of this temptation by forcing his son to reckon with what is really happening here and what you are really contributing to and how you are really abusing another human being. In this case, he tells his son, if you want to go with the crowd, at least be man enough to face what it is they actually do and what those things mean for others and the hurt and the harm that they cause. Like Sheol, these are the friends. Let us swallow them alive and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods, and we shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will all have one purse. Now, the father is clearly not telling his son, just do what I say because I tell you. He has experience of the world. He understands the pull of the temptation of the peer group, the seductive power of the crowd. He has felt it himself, and he knows how to explain it to his son. He knows what the group offers and promises. Their motivation is greed. But as he will say in verses 16 and following, he also knows what they actually deliver. Something very different than they promise. The gang promises to share its spoils. But can you trust thieves to protect your share? My son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths. We're here introduced for the first time to the metaphor of the path as a description of one's life, a metaphor that will appear often in the book of Proverbs. In fact, the two words used in verse 15, way and path, will occur more than 60 times in the book after this verse. There are, as always in Proverbs and always in the Bible, two paths, and only two. Remember the Lord's similar teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. The broad way that leads to death, the narrow way that leads to life, the broad way that is walked by so many, the narrow way on which comparatively few are found to walk. Well, we're aware in our society, aren't we, in this day and age, of the pull that especially young men feel from neighborhood gangs. How successful they are in enlisting disaffected young men who need a sense of identity and want a purpose for their lives. We're also very well aware of the remarkable conformity that we find among groups of young people in regard to their dress, their speech, their entertainment. No one can overestimate the power of the group to provide an identity for adolescents. But the same is true for adults. We speak of keeping up with the Joneses. And more than any of us, I think, wants to admit, our aspirations are shaped by our expectation of having a life like the life of other people. But the wise force their children to take note of and then to remember that there are but two ways, two paths, and no matter how few people walk the one that leads to life, it is absolutely critical, vital, that we find our feet firmly planted on that path. You will never get to the truth of anything by counting noses. Young people, I hope very much that your parents will instill in you a habit of thinking clearly about your life, about the various influences that bear down on it, about your future, about what it ought to be. Think about your friends. Choose them wisely, carefully, according to the influence they are likely to bear on your life. Choose the ones who are wise, who are going someplace, who are good and kind and honest and hardworking. There won't be quite as many of those. And then there will be still fewer of those who revere God and honor Him in their lives. With friends like those, you are much, much more likely to become that kind of person yourself. And you have only to look around you to see that those who become such people are not only living happier lives, but more important ones. Lives more useful, valuable to others, more satisfying for the value that they bring to others, more fulfilling for the rewards the Lord bestows on His children who live lives like that. And the reverse is also true, if only you will look and be honest about what you observe. The wrong friends drag the others in their group down. The pull of the crowd of a particular group of kids can be very strong. We know that. But think, what will I become if I go with them? It's this insight that leads to the consistent emphasis we will find throughout Proverbs on the importance of not even beginning down the path of the wicked. Because once on it, it is very difficult to get off. Far better never to have got on it at all. I notice again and again and again in dealing with people that there are many problems in life, the only real solution to which is never to have gotten into it in the first place. This is the truth so memorably summed up in Alexander Pope's famous verse, "Vice is a monster of so frightful a mien, an appearance, a mien. To be hated needs but to be seen, but seen too oft, familiar with that face, we first endure then pity, then embrace. That's why the culture of a Christian home is so vital to the formation of godliness in Christian children. Convictions established early, reinforced, driven down deep into the heart, will ever prevent a child from embracing the path of the wicked, no matter how powerful that temptation to do so may be. 16. For their feet run now the reasons. For their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Now the father's turning to the why. Why it's so wrong to follow this group, to walk in their way. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Not only is the path of sinners wrong, he's telling his son, it's stupid. It's not the way to a happy and fruitful life. It's the way to death. It always ends badly. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. Bernie Madoff. Two quotations very well sum up the verses we have read. First from C.S. Lewis. I wonder whether in ages of promiscuity, many a virginity has not been lost less in obedience to Venus than in obedience to the lure of the Caucasus. For, of course, when promiscuity is the fashion, the chaste are outsiders. They are ignorant of something that other people know. They are uninitiated. And as for lighter matters, the number who first smoke or first got drunk for a similar reason is probably very large. That is, you did it because everybody else was doing it. You wanted to fit in. How powerful, in other words, is the pressure placed upon us by our peers? But I also like this from Philip Massinger, the 17th century English playwright. His definition of peer pressure: the fury of the many-headed monster, the giddy multitude. Doesn't sound so attractive in Massinger's definition. The fury of the many-headed monster, the giddy multitude. Now, before we proceed, let me just say a word about the fact that the discourse we read and those that follow are cast primarily in the form of a conversation between a father and his son. Now, to be sure, this is an idealized father. Not all fathers are this wise or this careful to instruct their children. We have here a father as a Christian father ought to be. You fathers are to find yourself mirrored in this man and in the way he speaks to his son. And if you don't find yourself there, you need to change into the likeness of this ideal Christian father. Many children, including many Christian children, have fathers who are not like this. Many who are not like this at all, and who either never give advice to their children or advise them poorly, wrongly, badly. Children are not to listen to the counsel of fools, even if the fools happen to be their own parents. I know Christian fathers who care much more that their sons play football than that they grow up to be Christian men. I know some fathers who care much more that their sons learn to make money than that they learn to practice godliness. But still, it's a father, not a mother. It's a son, not a daughter. And such is the Bible most of the time. Only male babies were circumcised, as you remember. But that doesn't mean that anyone in that time supposed that only males counted, or that the issues of life were not the same for female children as they were for boys, necessary changes being made. Mothers and daughters are mentioned in the book of Proverbs, but more important, the entire Old Testament and the entire Bible bears witness to the fact that girls and women were just as obliged to live godly lives as were boys and men, and that the spiritual issues of life were broadly the same for the one as for the other. So while the discourse is cast in terms of sons and fathers and sons, the meaning is parents and children. You have the same thing in the New Testament where Christians of both sexes are referred to as brethren. We're all described as sons of God through faith in Christ. It is the generic masculine, just as we have it today in the common address, you guys. No one at the checkout counter ever looks at Florence and me and says, how are you girls doing today? It is always, how are you guys? Wise Christian women will not take offense, but will see the compliment that is paid to them in this biblical usage. To be a son in the Greco-Roman world was to be much more than to be a daughter. Your legal rights were much greater. Your opportunities much greater. You were given respect that girls and women were ordinarily not given. For the Bible to call you the sons of God in that day and age was the same thing as saying that it considered the church's women to have all the rights and to deserve all the respect that belonged to the church's men. And in that day and age, that was an extraordinary thing to say. The fact is, though the book of Proverbs is dominated by the language of father and son, the final paragraph, and in some respects the climax of the entire book, is all about a virtuous, gifted, skillful, accomplished woman. I came across this recently in the description, a description of the Hebrews as a people among the other peoples of the ancient Near East. But in one respect, the Hebrews tapped a physical resource which most ancient peoples denied themselves. They made full use of the brains and courage of their women. How it came about that so many great peoples, until quite recently, failed to draw upon half their human capital, we shall never know. But the Hebrews did not fail, just as well, since they had so little else. And the Bible is the record of their common sense. The Bible, unlike any comparable record of antiquity, continually places women in the forefront of events. Hebrew or Israelite society was patriarchal, as indeed all societies were then and indeed are now. But not exclusively so. Women were prized, too, for their wisdom, tenderness, passion, and at times, heroic ruthlessness. Think of Jael and Sisera, for example. So don't take Proverbs out of its larger theological and spiritual context. No religion in the world has made so much of women as Christianity because no holy book places them in such an exalted place as does the Bible. Their callings may not be the same as men in every respect, but their value is the same and their role is equally essential to the kingdom of God. So you women and girls, as we study Proverbs, remember that when fathers and sons are mentioned, the Hebrews themselves fully appreciated that mothers and daughters were intended as well. Now, to conclude this introduction to Proverbs, let's look at the book as a whole. We have begun to read chapter 1, which is part of the first section of Proverbs, a section that is comprised of the first 9 chapters. In one sense, these 9 chapters are an introduction to the Proverbs themselves that begin at chapter 10, verse 1. But in another sense, they are simply more of the same wisdom that will be found in a different form in the Proverbs themselves. In the first 9 chapters, we find counsel regarding peer pressure, as we've seen. We'll find advice regarding the keeping of our hearts, regarding the managing of controversy, regarding sexual temptation, regarding marriage, regarding our speech, and so on. As we said, the biblical term for proverb, mashal, can refer to all manner of sayings, including discourses such as we have in these first 9 chapters. All of this material is in praise of wisdom, as we said, in the form of a discourse between a father and a son. He is urging his son to grasp, to learn, to incorporate wisdom into his daily life. The Proverbs per se, or at least the Proverbs as we think of Proverbs, begin at chapter 10, verse 1, and are entitled the Proverbs of Solomon. The first group of them extends from chapter 10, verse 1, to chapter 22, verse 16. What is interesting about that is that if you take the time to count up the Proverbs, you will find that there are 375 of them in this first section. 375 of the Proverbs of Solomon. 375 is the numerical value of Solomon's name. If you remember, the Hebrews did not use numbers. They used letters to stand for numbers. The first 10 letters of the alphabet for the numbers 1 through 10, the 11th letter for the number 20, the 12th for 30, the 19th for 100, and so on. The S of Solomon's name is 300. The L is 30, the M is 40, and the H, which is in the Hebrew spelling, is 5. The vowels, as you remember, were not written in early Hebrew. The total of those letters is 375 when the letters are taken to be numbers. That's not likely to be an accident, though it has to be admitted that the use of letters for numbers is not known for sure to have been the practice as early as Solomon's time. But then the book of Proverbs, as we will see, was not complete in Solomon's time and may not have been complete until many centuries later. We know from other information in the Bible, for example, in 1 Kings chapter 4:32, we read that Solomon spoke 3,000 proverbs. We know that Solomon was a collector of proverbs, maybe the author of many others. We have a selection here, obviously. 375 is not 3,000. And obviously, given that it was only a selection, the editors perhaps included the number that would be equivalent to the numerical value of the great king's name. In 22:17, the next section begins, and this is a section of sayings, which are also proverbs in the larger sense of the Hebrew term mashal. We're told in verse 20 that there are 30 of them, but scholars disagree as to how precisely to divide the material up into 30 pieces. These sayings are more like the material in the first 9 chapters than they are like the short, pithy statements in the section entitled The Proverbs of Solomon. And we're not told who the wise men were. They're not identified, though it has long been noticed that this section and the next has a particularly close relationship to ancient Egyptian wisdom literature, especially the writing entitled The Instruction of Amenemope. The third section of the book, more sayings, or this third section of the book, rather, runs from 22:17 to 24:22. Then comes 24:23, a short section entitled in the ESV, More Sayings of the Wise. There are 5. You begin to get the picture. This book is composed of collections of wisdom material that are being added one to another. Once again, we're not told who these wise men were or where this material originated. Then at 25:1, we have a further collection of the Proverbs of Solomon, certainly implying that the previous 2 sections were not from Solomon. But this time, we're told that the collection was made by men who served in the court of King Hezekiah. Now we are in the 7th century B.C., not the 10th century of B.C., when King Solomon actually reigned. Perhaps the collection was part of Hezekiah's reforming effort in Judah. From this, it is obvious that the book in its present form took shape centuries after the time of King Solomon himself. The title of the book that we are given in chapter 1, verse 1, The Proverbs of Solomon, Son of David, King of Israel, remained the title for the whole book that includes the material of other wise men because Solomon was the principal author, and he was certainly the most distinguished of all the contributors to the book of Proverbs. There follows some sayings of Agur, an unidentified man, in chapter 30, some sayings of one King Lemuel, of whom we know nothing else, in 31:1-9, apropos our earlier remarks about women in Proverbs, it's noteworthy that what Lemuel teaches us is an oracle that his mother taught him. Whether Lemuel is also the author of the famous description of the excellent wife is another question without a definite answer. Such is the book that we're going to study through a number of Lord's Day evenings. It's a varied collection of wisdom material. And now here and now there are statements bearing on a whole variety of subjects having to do with the formation of our characters, having to do with a virtuous life, having to do with the skill of living well. It is not, therefore, a book to be preached through chapter by chapter, and almost never has been in the history of Christendom. In almost every commentary on the book, though you have a chapter by chapter explanation offered, you also have sections organized by subject with all the various proverbs dealing with that particular subject brought to bear on the conclusions that the commentator reaches about the teaching of the book. And that's what we're going to do as well. There may be, some have suggested there is, there may be some order to the various arrangements that you find in the chapters 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and so on, of the book of Proverbs. Some principle of organization of what seem on the surface to be rather random lists of statements jumping from one subject to another. But it's usually very hard to know if there is a principle of organization, and if so, precisely what that principle is. But that there is a great deal of extraordinarily valuable and useful material in this book is without question. And it's going to be our treat and our privilege to consider that material subject by subject in the weeks that follow. God willing. Amen.